Oh, look, I think Alison shows that she's got a very fine understanding of human rights in Australia. I'm really thrilled to be here today to talk with you about the issues of human rights, slavery and trafficking, and I'm especially pleased to be here with Linda. I saw Linda in action in Geneva at the UNHCR, and she with her colleague Eileen Petaway went to Geneva to the United Nations High Commission for Refugees NGO consultations, and they went with a whole team of students who advocated so successfully and participated so well in those important NGOs for us. And it was a real privilege to see those experts do that so well. And I know that Linda's work is especially striking, and I'm looking forward to hearing you a little bit later too. I'd like to say hello to my friends who are here, some of my comrades too, Ali. thank you for coming today to join us at the seminar. Thank you to CCS for inviting me to speak. And I'm very conscious that amongst the CCS community there are distinguished scholars in migration, in the area of migration, refugees, racism, and these are all key areas that intersect with the kinds of work that we've been doing at the Anti-Slavery Project. And as our project moves towards turning into a centre of the university, we hope that we can connect more with you, both at CCS and through Anti-Slavery. And I think that would be wonderful, because the kind of work we do is so clearly open to a multidisciplinary approach, and there is so much to do. So I hope that we can really crystallise those links between law and the other parts of UTS. I'm also here with my colleague Bryn O'Brien from Anti-Slavery, and you know, thank you, Bryn, for the work that you continue to do with us. Now, Anti-Slavery wrote a submission to the National Consultation on Human Rights, and we asked for a Human Rights Act too, and we're going to be very interested to see what the human rights framework looks like, and I was encouraged to hear Alison's optimistic view of the possible future of that kind of framework in Australia. Now, migration, global migration, is something that's extraordinary. You know, we've seen through statistics compiled by the United Nations that extraordinary numbers of people are migrating each year. The statistics that I saw very recently from the UN said that in this year, 2010, the numbers of people expected to migrate will vary between 188 million and 214 million. That's an extraordinary movement of people. That includes the refugee population. It includes people seeking to migrate for employment, you know, based on expert skills and expertise. But it also includes very many desperate and vulnerable people. And this is something that the International Labour Organization picked up in a 2009 report. The ILO said that as a result of the global financial crisis, they expected more people would be pushed to migrate, would be forced to migrate, because they are desperate. The ILO focused particularly on our region. They said that because of the global financial crisis within our region, more people would have no choice. They would be desperate. They would move for employment, because otherwise they would starve, or their families would starve, or they would suffer extreme hardship of other types. Within the context of Australia, we see a very extreme form of labour exploitation, and we're concerned to really cite the work that we do within anti-slavery and trafficking within the labour exploitation kind of discourse. Now, one of the things that we've been doing is to work with a whole lot of community organisations. And my colleague Bryn has been working particularly with the Seafarers Centre in Sydney, and you know, we're developing resources that, you know, as a result of a lot of consultation with a lot of other bodies, will be translated into many different languages and available for seafarers, you know, who come to our ports. This is the International Year of the Seafarer 2010, and you know, we're focused on rights for seafarers, and we know that seafarers are among the most vulnerable working communities in the whole world. So this is just something, you know, this is an example of one of our projects, and this one's been led by Bryn with the Seafarers Centre. But I wanted to show you that just to give you a flavour of some of the work that we've been doing. At the Anti-Slavery Project, we were kind of a curious mix of direct service provision to people who have been trafficked and enslaved in Australia, and also academic research. And I hope that when we form ourselves into a centre of the university, we'll be able to maintain those two focus areas of our work. So as lawyers, we give advice to men and women, mainly women, who have been trafficked into and enslaved in Australia. Last time we counted our clients, and we don't usually count them, we had 80. So we're providing legal advice and representation for 80 people who have been trafficked into Australia. Our client group mirrors what we know about this population nationally. So most of our clients are women. Most are women trafficked into Australia from countries in our immediate region. That means countries like Thailand, Malaysia, Vietnam, the Philippines, Korea, and it's always the thing when you do a list is who have I forgotten? I said China?
China.
So our client group pretty much reflects what we know about the trafficked population in Australia. So we've been very proud of the work that we've been doing. You know, by working with people directly, we feel that we understand as much as we can some of the experience that they've had, and we've been able to advocate for people very successfully with the Department of Immigration and with other government departments to achieve real human rights improvements for our clients. So in the last 4 months or so, we've been able to assist 15 women gain permanent residence in Australia. That's pretty amazing. We've been working in the refugee area because some of our clients are refugees, and we've been working in other parts of the migration program as well. But our approach has been, you know, to focus on the individual with regard to human rights, to respect the individual, to know very well the international statements, treaties and conventions in this area, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which Alison reminded us about, of course, says that no one shall be held in slavery or servitude. And there are other more specific international treaties. There's the UN Protocol that defines trafficking, conventions on forced labour, and the Slavery Conventions of 1926 and 1953. There's a whole body of international human rights instruments that guide us in our work. What we know is that slavery and trafficking in Australia is generally unidentified, unreported, and that means that people who experience these kinds of abuses don't get the protections that they're entitled to. This is a poster from the US. We're developing material like this for Australia, and we do have quite a big grant from the Attorney General's Department to do this kind of thing. But I think that this poster is really significant because many people, when they think about slavery, think of an Asian woman in a brothel. What we know is that slavery is much broader than that, and we need to develop tools and awareness mechanisms to identify slavery within the wider community. So it could be a person working in agriculture. Today, if you saw the news, you would have seen that the Department of Immigration arrested a group of people in Victoria and will deport them. Those people were working illegally in Australia. That's what the ABC News story said. But were they trafficked? There's no mechanism in place to screen people for trafficking or exploitation. That's a shame, and that's something that we're advocating for with the Department of Immigration. So clearly, the Migration Act of Australia says that to work without work permission if you're not a citizen or resident is unlawful. But sometimes people work because they're forced to work, because they have no choice. But a person who's working outside the sex industry is not screened for the possibility of extreme labour exploitation, trafficking or slavery. That's something that we're working on. Now, I want to show you what one of our clients said, and then I'd like to ask you how you would categorise this kind of exploitation. I'll just read it, and these are the words of our client, who incidentally did hold a working visa in Australia. Our client said, "I lost my job in my home country when the factory I worked in closed down. A friend introduced me to a man who said I could have a job at his factory in Australia. Although it was a hard decision to leave my family, I decided to come to Australia for 2 to 3 years to earn money. I wanted my family to have a better life. I needed to work and I couldn't get a job in my country. When I arrived in Australia, my boss took my passport away. For more than a year, I worked every day in the factory for 12 to 13 hours. I was not paid a wage or allowed to go outside by myself. For the first couple of months, the boss sent a small amount of money to my family, but then he stopped. The boss said that if I tried to escape, he'd kill my family in my home country. Immigration officers went twice to my workplace. The boss gave me a story to tell them about where I lived and how much I was paid. He told me that if anybody asks me why I am sleeping at work, I should say that I drank too much and couldn't drive home the night before." This is a person in Sydney working lawfully in Australia, and these are the work conditions. And what is this kind of exploitation? And that's what we're focusing on. And what kind of remedies should be available to a person like this? And what's the role of the criminal law and civil law in meeting the human rights needs and entitlements of a person in this situation? I'd like just to talk to you. I've been using the words trafficking and slavery and forced labour. I'd like to just tell you what they mean according to the international law definition. In 2002, the United Nations made the Protocol to Prevent and Suppress Trafficking in Persons. And in 2005, Australia ratified that protocol. The definition of protocol of trafficking in international law is this: that trafficking will have three parts, the process of trafficking. Firstly, there's the recruitment, transportation, transfer, harbouring or receipt of a person. So there's the movement of a person. That's stage one. Stage two is by the means of threat or force or coercion, abduction, fraud, deception, abuse of power, or of a position of vulnerability. That's a very important clause in this trafficking protocol: abuse of a position of vulnerability. So who in the world would be in a vulnerable situation that could be abused by a potential exploiter? We know they're our clients, but we know that after the fact. So it's the movement by means, which is the second stage, for the purpose of exploitation. So the trafficking protocol has three stages: movement, by the means for the purpose of exploitation. The protocol says that consent is irrelevant if any of the means have been used. So if a person is deceived or threatened or abducted or their position of vulnerability has been exploited, then it's irrelevant if they consent to being trafficked. And the UN protocol says that children are trafficked regardless of the means. So any child who's recruited or transported for the purpose of exploitation will be trafficked. Now this is a very important international convention. It's a very important definition, and this definition is being looked at around the world. Now, it's always been thought, and it was developed within the context of migration across borders. But what we're seeing is another kind of discourse that's emerging, and that is of people who, and especially children, who are exploited within the country's geographic borders. Trafficking is found in our criminal law. This kind of language here, that slavery is a condition of a person over whom any or all of the powers attaching to the right of ownership are exercised, is taken from the 1926 Convention on Slavery. So a condition where any or all of the powers attaching to the right of ownership are exercised. Now, what does this mean, and does it include not only the kind of slavery that existed in 1926, which was chattel slavery, where a person can be sold or bought or inherited, but does it include modern forms of slavery as well? And in the Australian case of Wei Tang, which the High Court handed down the decision in 2008, just seems like yesterday, the High Court of Australia defines slavery in the Australian context. It's a very significant decision in international law, and it's been reviewed all over the world. So the key to this is that slavery takes place when a person is subject to powers which are like the right of ownership. So if you own something, what can you do? You can do anything, can't you? Like, if I own this bit of paper, I can just rip it up like that. That's what slavery is. Slavery is the commodification of a person, treating a person like they're just an object. You know, curiously, in international law, and you'll know that for many years slavery was lawful, there was only one prohibition against the slave owner, and that was that a slave owner was not allowed to murder the slave, but everything else was fine. So this is treating a person as if they are a mere commodity, an object, where powers attaching to the right of ownership can be exercised. Now, so Wei Tang defined slavery. Interestingly, there are some other cases which are being heard now in the New South Wales court. But Wei Tang says that slavery takes place when a person is a commodity, when they are effectively controlled. So in the old days of the transatlantic slave trade, slaves were chained to the ship or imprisoned in a workplace, maybe a sugarcane field, as happened in Australia. But here, where we see this new kind of concept of slavery, where sometimes the people who are enslaved have apparent freedom of movement, if you look at them from the outside, they seem to be able to move around the city sometimes. Sometimes they even have a mobile phone. Are they enslaved? What circumstances must come into effect for them to be enslaved, and how is that their situation different from a person who is in labour, a situation of exploited labour? So the High Court adopted the facts, of course, from the trial, and the trial judge said even though sometimes they are allowed to go out and the defence said, why didn't they escape? They could have. They could have run into a police station and said, help me. They could have run away. Why didn't they? The judge said, how could they? How could they run away? They didn't have any money. They didn't have their passport. They came to Australia on a visa. It was a genuine visa, but it wasn't a real visa for them because they came here with the intention to work. They came on a visitor visa. They didn't have much English. They didn't have any friends. They believed what the traffickers told them. Don't go to immigration. Don't have any contact with law enforcement. Law enforcement won't protect you. And, of course, let's not forget the debt of around about $45,000 that they believe they had to pay off before they were free. They believe that if they didn't pay off that amount of money, then they could be hurt or their families could be hurt. So even though sometimes they might have had seamless movement, apparently, they didn't really, because they were controlled, they were coerced. And this kind of picture of slavery is sometimes called modern-day slavery, to distinguish it from what used to be known as chattel slavery. Now, forced labour is interesting to look at, the Forced Labour Convention. how am I going for time?
You're about halfway
there. Oh, okay. Forced labour is work or service exacted from any person under the menace of any penalty for which the person hasn't offered themselves voluntarily. Now, when this convention, which was drafted back just around about the same time as the original slavery convention, this one in 1930, there was a clear distinction in the international community between chattel slavery and forced labour. But what we're now faced with today is that the concepts of forced labour and slavery have in fact merged. And so I think that if we found a person in slavery now today, they would also, under the international law, be in a forced labour situation. And this is a very interesting development, and one which really challenges the way that we look at employment and protections in Australia and indeed around the world. Now, here are a couple of case studies. So we've looked at in our discussion the meaning of slavery and trafficking and forced labour, and you know, these could be any people working in Australia. They could be working lawfully or unlawfully, but what's the difference? How do we tell when a person is trafficked, subject to forced labour and enslaved, from a person who's in a really bad job and paid almost nothing? That's all right. So this is the thing. And it's important because the protections that are available for one group aren't available for the other groups. What we think is that the exploitation is the same. You have to look at what's being done to the person, look at the nature of the exploitation, and then work upwards. So, you know, if we filled in the table, I think that you'd see that there are just clear similarities between slavery and trafficking and forced labour. So what are the differences and what are the challenges for us? In Australia, we know that there has been exploitation in a whole lot of different industries. The way that we work is by working closely with government and community organisations. We are a member of the National Roundtable on People Trafficking. We did draft the guidelines for NGOs working with trafficked people, which is now going into its second edition. We do convene an anti-slavery network. If any of you are interested, contact us, because it's important. We haven't been able to connect very successfully with the unions, and that's because, why do you think that? Unions are under-resourced, they've got to focus on their members, and these are bigger issues, and all of us are under-resourced. We're all under-resourced in this sector, and really there should be a clear connection between the union movement and us and the other community groups, but so far we haven't been able to crystallise that. You know, we've convened seminars, we all have goodwill, but we haven't been able to really do anything about it yet. Now, the upcoming challenges for us, in addition to everything I've already said, are that we need to look really carefully at the kind of exploitation that can go hand in hand with a whole range of visas. So I didn't even put student visas up there, which was a pure oversight. But think about student visa holders. How vulnerable can they be? They have a 20-hour a week work limitation. Sometimes they work beyond 20 hours a week, and then they're vulnerable, aren't they? The employer says, you're working over 20 hours a week, you're breaching your visa conditions, I'm going to report you to immigration, unless you work 40 hours a week and at a reduced pay level. Domestic servitude and partner and fiancé visas. We need to do more work with our communities to talk about partners and visas and fiancés. We know that within the migration scheme there is something called the domestic violence provision that exists for temporary spouse visa holders, that if a relationship breaks down because of domestic violence, then there could be a permanent visa to the visa applicant. But what we're seeing is more cases of women who are sponsored in Australia who are working after arrival in a situation of such exploitation that it's in fact forced labour or slavery. So it's really important for us to look at ways of reaching out into all our communities to talk more about these issues and these definitions and the protections that can be available. Because within families, within migration visas, generally these concepts aren't considered. The Migrant Resource Centres, a lot of the community groups, all know about the domestic violence provisions, but they don't yet know about these other kinds of protections that might exist. That's a real shame, because it could mean that there are people who continue to be enslaved because nobody knows that there's in fact a remedy for them. Now, I know what I want to do. Hang on. Okay, contact information. Does anybody here use Twitter apart from Ben and me?
I'm actually tweeting.
Oh, excellent. Oh, are you? We love Twitter.
In fact, there's someone else in the room tweeting.
Really?
Someone else.
Oh, that's funny.
And I just retweeted what you tweeted.
So we like Twitter. We're also on Facebook, and that's my phone number, and that's the email address. Please contact us. Can I have a few more minutes? Am I still within time? Okay, that's all right. I've just got you one more thing to show you, and this is a film that's been made. So, and it's within time. Thank you, everybody.